Think about the qualities that drive great American innovators. What comes to mind? Well, they've got to be tenacious, independent, ambitious, and you know what? It doesn't hurt to be a little obsessive. In his book, America's Obsessives, journalist Joshua Kendall profiles seven iconic American innovators, from Steve Jobs to Estee Lauder to the baseball legend Ted Williams. He tells Steve Paulson these all-American super achievers had one crucial thing in common. They were compulsive.
And these were individuals who all had these obsessions and compulsions, but in their case, it led to staggering success. So rather than being a liability, the obsessions and compulsions were an asset, and it enabled them to jumpstart their careers and to continue to function at an extremely high level throughout their professional lives.
And it would seem because they were all perfectionists in some way. I mean, the negative spin would be they were control freaks, but they wanted to get everything exactly right.
And that took a toll on their personal lives. Most of them were very unhappily married or didn't have good relationships with their kids. But in their professional lives, it put them, in Ted Williams's case, it put him in the Hall of Fame.
Ted Williams, who was obsessed with how he swung the bat.
Right. He was obsessed with his swing. He was so obsessed with hitting a baseball that his pickup line to women was, "Show me your swing." And he thought that was a way of connecting. And he would literally carry the bat with him all over the place. His bat.
Wait, are you serious? Like, he'd go out to a restaurant, he'd carry his bat with him?
Not quite that extreme, but when he was a manager of the Senators, he would be holding a bat at all times. And he had this hitter on the Senators. This is in the late 60s, after he's retired from the Red Sox. And he tells the Senators' worst hitter, "Carry a bat with you wherever you go." And Brinkman has the best year of his career and hits about 280. So he tried to sort of steep his players in his own obsessions, and it often worked.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, let's talk about some of the other people that you write about. Henry Heinz, founder of the iconic ketchup company. What was his compulsion?
He loved measuring things, and he carried a tape measure wherever he went. And in the middle of a meeting, he might just start, you know, measuring the door or something. He took it, pretty far. I mean, he goes to Germany, back to his native country with his family one summer, and he keeps a diary. And in his diary, he's obsessed with the measurements of the ship. And it's something that he can't stop thinking about. And I guess other obsessives, one of the other obsessives is Melville Dewey of the Dewey Decimal System. And the Dewey Decimal System, you know, organizes knowledge through the number 10. It's a decimal system. It really was the kind of Google of its age. But for Dewey, decimals weren't just a way of organizing information. They were a way of living. He used to say that he liked to sleep decimally. He liked to get...
what does that mean, to sleep decimally?
10 hours a night. He just felt most comfortable with 10 hours a night. And then Dewey, in his 50s, starts Lake Placid, which is a resort for very, very nervous teachers in upstate New York. And everything there is organized decimally. You know, it has a 10 p.m. curfew, and there's a train that leaves from Lake Placid at 10 p.m. And again, tens were kind of in his blood. But the amazing thing is that we know Dewey today because that obsession led to this innovation. And it was, again, the Google of its age. And it was instrumental in organizing knowledge at the turn of the 20th century.
But there's often a dark side to these obsessions. So in the case of Dewey, he also had kind of these sexual obsessions, didn't he?
Yes. Obsessions often go with sexual compulsivity. And Dewey, to put it mildly, couldn't keep his hands off the librarians. Today, we're kind of used to sexual harassment, and we see it a lot. But in those days, it was kind of in the closet. So any cases that we read about from the early 1900s must have been very extreme to get noticed and for the women to be believed. And Dewey was kicked out of the American Library Association.
Wow. I mean, he's the guy who basically revolutionized libraries, yeah. And he got kicked out of their trade group.
Yeah, and he had to retire at the age of 50 because over a 10-day trip, he grabbed four different women, and they all complained. This was in about 1905.
Wow. Now, there's another innovator you write about, first woman we're talking about, cosmetics pioneer Estée Lauder, whose luxury brand was built really because of her nose. She had this incredibly fine sense of smell. And she came from rather humble background, didn't she?
Yes, most of them, the obsessives, came from kind of hardscrabble Dickensian childhoods. And that's often where the obsessions start. In Estée Lauder's case, her mother is a Jewish immigrant from Hungary. She just knew Yiddish. And then her mother has six children, and then the father leaves. And so Estée's mother has six children and no husband in this strange country. And then she meets another European Jew, and she marries him. So problem solved. There's only one knot, which is that now she's worried that husband number two is going to leave her because he's 10 years younger. And when Estée is about 3 or 4 years old, her mother begins every day with an elaborate beauty ritual. Her father goes out to work, and her mother is scared that husband number two is going to leave. So she starts combing her hair, putting on makeup, and just trying to be beautiful. And Estée, as a little girl, age three, is helping her mother every day.
Talk about a founding myth someone who's going to found a beauty empire, a cosmetics empire. I mean, you know, getting it from your mother.
Well, not only doing it to your mother, and that's what she did for the rest of her life every single day. She couldn't stop putting makeup on women because for her, making her mother beautiful sort of kept her family intact, and she couldn't stop doing it. I interviewed her granddaughter. She grew up in New York in the 70s, and Estée used to accompany her to PTA meetings at her private school. So as soon as she meets the teacher, she gives the teacher a makeover.
Wait. You have to explain. She reaches out. She touches the teacher's face?
Oh, yes. Yes. She can't stop touching face. She'd do makeovers on people in elevators, in trains. I mean, she cannot stop touching faces.
Hmm. So in all of these cases, you're saying there was adversity in childhood that really created these compulsions. They weren't necessarily born with them. I mean, there was something that was happening in their childhood, and they were kind of nervous wrecks, and this was their compensation.
Yes, it was a kind of survival mechanism. People don't know this about Ted Williams, but his mother was very poor, and she wasn't around much when he was a kid. She wanted to save all San Diego's drunks, and she would be riding the buses at all hours of the night. He described her once as a Salvation Army nut. He was very isolated, and what he would do to calm himself down was swing the bat, and that's how he sort of bonded with his bat. The bat became kind of his attachment figure. You know, again, I talked about his blanket. I mean, the bat became his connection to the world.
What I find amazing about this story is that just by swinging the bat over and over again, you know, probably watching yourself in the mirror do it, that you could actually become a great baseball player that way. Somehow I wouldn't think that kind of practice would actually turn into greatness.
And that's what's so interesting is how, because compulsions, again, are things that they can't stop doing, but that, you know, in his case, he just kept on swinging. Or in Estée Lauder's case, she just kept on putting makeup on people, and you just do it again and again and again. And it led to some kind of major innovation and kind of shaping our culture.
And yet, when we talk about these kind of obsessive personality traits, I mean, these are disorders. As far as I know,
yes,
they are still classified as pathologies in the DSM, aren't they?
Yeah. So there's a lot of confusion about the diagnostic nomenclature. The main confusion is between obsessive compulsive disorder, which is very disabling, and I argue that these individuals had obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is disabling when it comes to human relationships, but not necessarily when it comes to your profession. Now, obsessive compulsive disorder are people who have a hard time functioning, and they have thoughts that are scary. So maybe they'll think that their hands are dirty, and they'll just keep washing their hands until they cut the skin. I mean, they might spend 10 hours a day washing their hands. They're just convinced that they're affected with germs. So those aren't people who are going to start Apple like Steve Jobs or write the Declaration of Independence like Thomas Jefferson, whom I profile, or build a billion-dollar business like Estee Lauder. People with obsessive compulsive disorder are impaired from functioning. But people with obsessive compulsive personality disorder, so these are people who love rules and order and perfection, those folks can function at a very, very high level. They almost function better than well because they have all the sort of extra juice.
So it sounds like what you're saying is we need a more nuanced understanding of compulsive, obsessive people, that it's not quite as blanketly negative as we tend to think. You're saying that, I mean, to some degree, these people have made the world, or at least made America.
Yes, yes, that they can be extremely influential, and in their careers, they can really stand out. And just that our society is just so competitive, and it's been that way since the founding era, that people who are perfectionists, and you know, a lot of them are just totally preoccupied with work. Think about Steve Jobs, who basically revolutionized seven different industries, you know, and he dies in his mid-50s. I mean, just the imprint that he left was amazing. But they're kind of on hyperdrive. You know, you know those stories about a woman who sees her baby under a car and just all of a sudden lifts the car up.
Right.
It's as if these innovators have that kind of energy, you know, day in and day out for decades.
You mentioned Steve Jobs, and I guess we all know, we've all heard stories about how perfectionistic he was in his work at Apple. In what way was he obsessively compulsive?
Just about innovation and design. My book starts with a scene when he's building the first Macintosh computer, and the factory has to be absolutely spotless. He says it should be so spotless that you can eat off the floor. And he also was obsessed with design. When he's dying of cancer, he had tubes in his chest, and he literally rips them out, and he tells the doctor that he just can't stand the design. I mean, his claim to fame is designing these amazing products, and that's just something he couldn't stop thinking about.
Well, it's a great story. Thank you for coming in and talking about it.
My pleasure.
Joshua Kendall is the author of America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. He was talking with Steve Paulson.